Welcome! You're listening to The Creative Spark with award-winning author, actor, four-time Ironman triathlete, coach, and TEDx speaker G. Brian Benson, where he chats up inspiring, creative, and thought-provoking authors, athletes, actors, artists, and entrepreneurs from all walks of life as they share their stories, success habits, struggles, and wisdom that propelled them to their own unique version of success. Be prepared each episode to be inspired, learn something new, and have some helpful takeaways that will provide insight, empowerment, and tools to live your best life.
Jeffrey Weissman, my next guest, I would call an actor's actor. I kind of feel like he would have been going by horseback or wagon from town to town before the advent of film and television, reciting Shakespeare or performing plays in small towns all over the countryside. He acts, produces, writes, and directs, and has worked with legendary film actors such as Clint Eastwood and Michael J. Fox. Jeffrey has over 100 theater stage credits and over 80 film and TV credits, and has been a working actor since the mid-1970s. He has been a player and artistic director in many improv troupes, as well as co-starred in many storied Hollywood features, such as Back to the Future 2 and 3, Pale Rider, and Twilight Zone the movie. On television, he has appeared in such fabled shows as Diagnosis Murder, Dallas, Saved by the Bell, Max Headroom, and Scarecrow and Mrs. King, just to name a few. Jeffrey continues to work in theater and film while venturing into theme parks, trade shows, improv, and sketch shows with a great deal of success. He is also a mentor, teacher, and coach, and he currently resides in the Sierra foothills, figuring out how to live sustainably. Welcome, Jeffrey.
What up, G?
Hey, how's it going, buddy?
All right, Brian. It's nice to hear your voice again. We met up here in the Sierra foothills, what?
In 2011, about 13 years ago at the Twain Hart Film Festival.
Was that Guitar Man of yours?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Oh, that's kind of you to remember. Yeah, it was my very first short film, and I believe you were there for a feature film called Uncorked?
Corked.
Oh, Corked, excuse me, Corked.
Yeah, it's because all the characters in that story were slightly off, like a corked bottle of wine.
I remember enjoying it. I think it was a feature on one of the evenings, correct?
Yeah. It was a mockumentary that came out about the same time as Bottle Shock. And it won all sorts of awards around the world. I played an OCD winemaker in it.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
What? It's a cult film now. I'm going to see it going for $300 a copy.
Really?
Yeah. My wife wants me to mention that she was in it playing my wife.
Okay. You just did. Perfect. And what is her name? So everybody knows that too.
Kimball Jackson.
Kimball Jackson.
We met doing theater. She was on the crew and I was on stage when in 1972, when I was, she was 12, I was 14.
Wow. Wow. You've been doing this your whole life. So what got you to that point at the age of 14? You know, what got you into acting? What inspired you to get into theater?
I was a ham.
Still are.
Yeah, I kind of learned the hard way through being such a show off and getting myself into trouble with serious actors who I was upstaging or whatever. I learned my lessons, and I hope, and started focusing more on the craft and storytelling rather than trying to be the center of attention.
That's awesome. Where did you really begin to learn your chops? I mean, I know you've been doing it forever and you probably just gained a little bit each step along the way and by witnessing somebody that had been doing it longer than you, et cetera, confidence. But, you know, where did you really learn to kind of feel like, you know, I can do this?
Well, I think it's a cumulative. I grew up in Hollywood. You know, my dad ran private clubs and a lot of actors, producers, directors played cards or backgammon at his clubs. And he would get advice for me. I would find shows that were shooting on location in my neighborhood and go talk with the actors, you know, as a kid. Wow. And my parents wouldn't let me act professionally, even though I had friends who were acting in front of the camera as kids, but they wanted me to stick to my schooling. Mm-hmm. And so I learned from stories from actors in the industry that I knew, and then also in school, slowly but surely, you know, training and eventually going to the American Conservatory Theater and university.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, on set, when I was 18, my parents couldn't tell me I couldn't do it anymore. I just jumped, joined a company that supplied background just to get on sets. I wanted to experience working professional sets at the major studios. And so some of my early credits are on these films like The Rose and Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, FM. And it was very exciting, but also ultimately unfulfilling because background work is just that. It's mostly sit around and wait until you are walking through with a bit of business maybe. And that's not really fulfilling for an actor if you want to sink your chops into something. And so I needed to get training on my resume. Mm-hmm. And that's why I set my sights on the American Conservatory Theater, because I really couldn't afford Juilliard at the time. Ironically, while going to ACT and then San Francisco State University, I fell into an opportunity to return to Hollywood sort of as a hot item, because I was offered a screen test for the lead in a film called War Games, 1982.
Was that the Matthew Broderick film?
It was. And I tested with Ali Sheedy. The same day I tested names like Eric Stoltz and Dana Carvey, Brian Backer, John Stockwell. There were about six of us who tested with Ali that day, and none of us got it. Martin Brest was the original director on the project. But I had a very aggressive agent pursue me and said, you know, you're the only actor testing that didn't come through an agent submission. I came in through an open call that Martin was conducting in five different cities. And he really wanted me. If I was the only one out of an open call in five cities, my ego, you know, inflated. I must be pretty special. Right. But I was, to put a multi-million dollar film on the shoulders of an unknown was practically unheard of at the time. And but nonetheless, my agent believed in me, the director believed in me, and that was the impetus for getting me signed with her and moving back to LA. As much as I had fallen in love with San Francisco Bay Area, it was just really a time where I felt, for the first time, I could be the freaky little nerd that I was or am. And without judgment, in San Francisco at that time, you had all sorts of freaks living and it felt like home. So I had a hard time moving back to Los Angeles, where it was a place I felt where you were scrutinized. It was very self-conscious. And that, you know, coming into play as an actor, it was very, very difficult for me. I struggled with auditions, especially because I wanted to please others as opposed to kind of please myself first. You know, I was doing my Libra nature of let's all be happy here. And I don't know if I'm getting ahead of the creative process here that this show is all about.
No, this is great. Yeah, no, this is great. You know, it is interesting. We'll just briefly touch on this, then we'll I've got another great question for you. But in auditions, and I learned, I mean, I like 2% of the, you know, experience that you do. But it's when you start doing it at a young age, or when you start doing it, period, there is that tendency to try to kind of give them what you think they want rather than just be yourself and really stand out, because there's a lot of people trying to give them what they want. And it's different. It's a different energy. It's a different, you know what I mean? I think to really pull something and grab a role, you need to kind of be different, correct?
Well, you have to be the best at being yourself, really, in the inhabiting the character.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about the traumas in our lives and using them as a basis that would work for a character's traumas, you know, bringing to life character traits, idiosyncrasies, twitches, whatever, these colors, and then putting those characters in the story, it is something that really takes a lot of thought and practice and planning. And often you get a script the night before and you're going in the next day and trusting, you know, that they know what they want. And often you'll hear the casting director say, well, we'll know what we want when we see it.
Right. Right.
It's like, wait a minute. And I, you know, because I was weaned on theater, I was often too big for the camera, or I would dress the part, which no one usually does in Hollywood, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, learn and eventually found my way. I think after 3 months of doing auditions as a hot item, I finally went in and met with George Miller, Marcy Luroff and Mike Fenton's casting company brought me in, and Fenton Feinberg. And I had a lovely meeting with the Australian director, George Miller, I was a huge fan of his Mad Max movies.
Yeah.
And it was his first Hollywood film to do a segment on Spielberg's Twilight Zone movie, which I was surprised they were going to continue shooting, because it was several months after the terrible accident where Vic Morrow and the children were killed. And but nonetheless, Spielberg wanted to finish the film. And my audition was to come in and tell a joke. So all my inhibitions kind of went out the window, because I called my grandfather, who was a humorist, who gave me his best joke. And I called other friends and got another good joke. So I was prepared and relaxed and just hit it off with George, who is a delightful human being. Mm. And I got the role and really enjoyed getting along and getting to know John Lithgow and Donna Dixon and J.D. Johnson, the cast, Abby Lane. You know, there were just a lovely ensemble cast. Margaret Fitzgerald, who played my wife in that. We would come up with bits that weren't in the script that George Miller loved in rehearsal. And of course, most of it got cut because of the pace of that thing.
Sure.
But it was a true feeling of collaboration and creativity. Mm. And that was just a magnificent gift, to have my first co-star role in a major motion picture be a situation like that. And it repeated again a number of years later on Pale Rider, the Clint Eastwood film.
Yeah, and I remember
on that one, once again, that very aggressive agent I had, Paula Cedar, she found out that a role had come available over at Warner Brothers that wasn't going to go out in the breakdowns, which is where agents find out about what's casting to submit their actors on. Mm-hmm. Apparently Chris Penn, Sean Penn's very talented younger brother, who's not with us anymore, he had met Clint at a party and said, I want to do a film with you. And Clint sent him the Pale Rider script, which the writers later learned had been trying to get Clint to do for many, many years. Mm. And I don't think Clint wanted to get back in the saddle, but they finally threw enough money at him or whatever, bought him a bus. And Chris was offered the role of Eddie Conway. Chris threw it back at Clint, said, I don't want to play a good guy, I want to play a bad guy. So the casting had carried on, most of the roles were filled, and Clint gave Chris the LaHood Jr. bad guy role. Mm-hmm. The actor who was cast as Teddy Conway got moved into Eddie, and the Teddy role came open. And because I was the right age for it, my agent got me in. Lauren Lloyd and Warner Brothers Casting thought they were going to cast it through their own files. I went in knowing that I was going to have to cry on cue. The scene was the boys,
when your dad gets shot,
is crying over daddy's dead body and doing Eddie's lines too. And I didn't want to leave anything to chance. Talk about the creative process. Over the years, I've studied a lot of different techniques of acting. Sort of the method, sense memory, emotional recall, the Meisner fantasy charging, subjective personalization technique, where you ground into a prop, an emotional place that you've been. And then I also had a very Zen oriented technique, where you just kind of put all your attention away from yourself and let the writing, if it's good enough, it's going to inhabit you and you're going to believe the truth of that. So I had it all going for me. I was did my homework to have backups in case something didn't work. I had something else to rely on if I could do another take or what have you. Or even in the moment, I had a lock of my grandmother's hair in my pocket that she was really the only one in my family who really encouraged me to pursue my acting, where everyone else was saying, no, it's too tough of a life. You can't do it. No, blah, blah, blah. And I adored her. I had the fantasy charging of my own father's possible death. And I had, you know, all these different sense memories and so on and so forth that I was using or going to use. And when the producer put me on film to send to Clint, I really just used the last one, the Zen sort of approach, combined with a little bit of each of the others, and the tears came effortlessly. And, you know, that was like on a Friday, and on Monday I was on an airplane heading to Idaho to shoot the film for better part of 5 weeks.
Wow, were you just pinching yourself?
Yeah.
What was Clint like?
Clint was a gentleman. He was wonderful, very easy to work with in that he didn't, well, it was a mixed bag with intimidation because he's Clint.
Right. Clint, and he's tall.
He's tall. He's in his duster and soft-spoken, you know. And so that alone is a bit intimidating. But as a director, he would not say action, but rather it was often whenever you're ready.
I've heard that. That's so interesting.
Oh, it's a gift. It's really lovely because I think he learned from, I had heard Don Siegel, who directed him in Dirty Harry movies. And then Don learned from, I think, John Ford, director of Westerns, that they noticed that actors get tense when they hear action, or they're yelling, you know, it's all German. Oh my God. You know, and their shoulders go up and they get self-conscious. Whereas Clint would shoot the rehearsals that he learned from these other legends and often would get a natural performance because the actors aren't self-conscious and they're trying things out. And often if they get it in the rehearsal, they don't even have to do a take and they can move on, which actually happened. The scene where Daddy gets shot from head to toe. And that took us 3 days to shoot that scene.
Oh my.
Because Doug, who is playing Spider, I'd heard also that Rip Torn was originally desired for Spider, and I don't know why he didn't do it, but Doug did a great job. Doug McGrath, every time he'd have to get shot, you know, they put the blasts for the gun shots and blood and wounds and everything. Every time they'd have to reset for another angle and a different section of his body being shot and so on and so forth, it was a complete costume change and a complete set redressing.
Okay. Yeah.
So it took forever. And the first day of shooting, we were in sunshine. The second day, we were in a blizzard. And the third day, all the snow had melted and they had to bring in the oil-based snow. And the wind would come up and pick up the snow in chunks and blow it through, you know, when we get to Daddy's body and stuff from the mercantile. So it was really interesting. And the editor was really brilliant with these quick cuts that it doesn't really register when you look at it, that it goes from sunlight to blizzard. Us, you know, Daddy, brother and I are screaming, Daddy, Daddy, over in the blizzard at the mercantile, which is the second day of shooting. It's really interesting. Sunlight, blizzard to fake snow.
I'm going to have to watch that again for sure.
You scrutinize it. You know, even Michael Moriarty in an earlier scene gets into that first fight in town. Was it Charlie Hallahan and Marvin McIntyre? Someone was messing around during the rehearsal, the fight rehearsal, and broke Michael Moriarty's three of his fingers.
Oh, my.
One of his hands, and he quit the show. Clint took him a couple of days to get Michael back on the show. And when he's going back into town, he doesn't hide the cast on his hand driving the buckboard. That's something else for you to look for.
Okay, a little Easter egg.
Yeah, there's a few of them in that. And that, once again, like I originally set out to discuss in my, is this a diatribe? My long monologue, whatever this is, of the blessing of being in a creative situation with an ensemble cast. It just is a dream. I had a mutual friend with Carrie Snodgrass. And when I met Carrie, we hit it off immediately. And she was a fierce, God rest her, wonderful actress, beautiful talent, and often butted heads with Moriarty and Eastwood because she saw her character as being stronger and wouldn't do some of the submissive things that she wouldn't let Hull Barrett go into town and wanted to hold those horses and have more of a push-pull conflict, and which would have been really dramatic and lovely as an actress that really did that stuff well. Like, you know, her first film, Diary of a Mad Housewife, she got nominated for an Academy Award. She was really fierce. But she would butt heads because Clint didn't want the character to be that aggressive. And anyway, she almost quit the film a few times.
Oh, my.
I would calm her down. Carrie, have another strawberry daiquiri or margarita, whatever. And she'd just vent and finally go to bed, you know, and stay on the film. There are a lot of really great moments, discussions I had, you know, with legendary actors on that. Fran Ryan, who is the Mrs. Blankenship, and John Russell, who is you know, the Stockwell, the evil marshal, and I had great meals and talks with them about stuff in their careers. I wish IMDb and Wikipedia existed back then in 84 when we shot, because I would have researched and realized who I was working with, you know.
Right, all these people that have been in the business for a long time.
Yeah, the stories I could have got out of Richard Dysart, and you know, of course, Clint, I would surprise him every once in a while with something that I'd find from France that had his picture on it. It was, where'd you get this? Oh my, you know, it was really lovely. Same thing would happen on other films. I worked with Michael Keaton on Johnny Dangerously, and I only brushed by Maureen Stapleton very early one morning on her way to the makeup. And I was agog, seeing her, and
right. She Edith didn't even Bunker. Look at me.
Yeah. She didn't even look at me. She just kept walking in her housecoat, whatever, with her paper under her arm, and said, it's not nice to look at an old woman first thing in the morning, you know? And it's just like, sorry, you know, but it was just so cool to be with such great talents on the same sets. And that's something that I adore. Getting on the set with, you know, Zemeckis's cast for the Back to the Future sequels was thrilling. A lot of hard work to do, but being in such great company, you know, working with Dick Van Dyke. I remember telling him on Diagnosis Murder, at one point he learned that I had played Stanley Laurel at Universal Studios for 15 years, and he was dear friends with Stanley. And at one point I said, you know, Dick, when I was a kid watching your show and Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and all, so I wanted to grow up to be you. And he got this kind of glaze over his eyes and tried to think, why he wanted to be me. Interesting. You know, I was like, well, I not new, but I, you know, have your career. Anyway, Dick was just lovely. And because of my love of old comedy, he opened up and told me a lot of stories about his time with Stanley Laurel and Buster Keaton, and his work on the comic, the Carl Reiner directed film, where he directed a lot of scenes of Dick and Suzanne Plochette doing silent movie stuff that never got used in that film. And anyway, I've been very fortunate, and I hope to continue to be fortunate and keep working.
Oh no, that's amazing. I mean, we could talk about your stories forever. Is there an actor or director you've always wanted to work with that you have not worked with yet?
Oh yeah.
Name a few.
Name a few. Oh boy. Well, Ron Howard, Rob Reiner, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola,
Steven Spielberg, which you already kind of did a little bit.
I've been on 5 projects that Spielberg was involved with.
Wow.
I Want to Hold Your Hand. Even though it was, you know, early background days for me, I was a Ringo fan outside the Beatles hotel room. And Zemeckis, even though he was the director, he wasn't comfortable, or for some reason didn't want to solely direct the crowd scenes. And Spielberg came in and directed the scene I'm in. And then Twilight Zone movie and the Back to the Future sequels. Mm-hmm. And it was during Back to the Future 2, Spielberg came up to me and I'm in a body cast to do a special effect and really couldn't move. So I was kind of trapped, and he came up very quietly and said, "Oh, so Crispin, I see you got your $1 million after all." And I was like, "What?" I didn't know why Crispin didn't return to do George McFly. I thought he had another film that he couldn't get out of.
That was a money
thing. Scheduling wise. And this informed me that he was holding out for $1 million. And I was like, so upset, because my agent didn't negotiate very well on that.
Oh gosh. Well, I mean, for our listeners who don't know, you played George McFly in 2 and 3, and you replaced Crispin Glover, as you're kind of mentioning. Yes.
Yeah. And they had to have him, so it appeared that he was still in the film for believability in the story, but they, unbeknownst to me, didn't get permission for his life mask that they based the prosthetics that I wore on, the makeups.
Oh.
And, you know, it turned into a huge court suit. Crispin sued Universal for $1 million. And I was in the middle of all that. And it was kind of a sticky. And because I knew Crispin, I'd worked with him at AFI and had his number and called him from time to time. You know, it came out that I was friends and had talked with him. And it's how the reason he got his settlement. But nonetheless, that kind of blew up in my face, and my life turned around for a while when Universal was taking it out on me. I continue working. I got to work. It's in my system. And the fans of Back to the Future internationally have embraced me, which is lovely.
Well, you've done a lot of the reunions, and I know that I've seen those sometimes come through on social media, and it seems like you're all having a really nice time and making a lot of people happy.
We are. And because I'm such a social guy, a lot of these fans that I meet around the world become friends, you know, I'm helping produce a Back to the Future Part 3 fundraiser for Mike Fox's foundation for Parkinson's research, mm-hmm. where the film was shot up here in the area that, you know, Columbia, Sonora, and Jamestown.
Yeah.
And we have fans coming in from around the world to play kind of role play, cosplay Back to the Future Part 3 and raise money for the cause. So we're very excited about that. That's
amazing.
Just a couple weeks.
You know, I checked out the website and it looks like a lot of fun. And there's a lot of interesting actors that will be there. Is it Burton? That gentleman, was that his name? Gilliam? What's his name?
Burton Gilliam is.
Yes, Blazing Saddles. I mean, you just recognize
like
you
would
shit eating grin everywhere, right? I mean, he's so funny.
And Paper Moon, and of course, Back to the Future Part 3. I finally met him. I'd spoken on the phone with him in years past, but I finally met him a year ago at a Chiller Theater show, a fan con in New Jersey. Mm. And he came dressed in his outfit from Blazing Saddles.
No way.
And he's got that shit-eating grin, and he's sweet as can be. And I remember introducing him to James Tolkien, and he kind of pointed to James Tolkien and says, "I bet I'm older than you." And James says, "No, you're not older than me." And they had this little battle that I was in the middle of that was just golden. And to me, that's, you know, legendary Hollywood royalty. To hear their stories, James Tolkien, who worked with Sidney Lumet on Serpico, and just so many other fantastic films, and once James and I were part of the Back to the Future stars at a Comic-Con in London, and Leonard Nimoy was the Star Trek star of that show. And about midday, James and I were having a coffee in the green room. And Nimoy comes in, looks around, sees James, and comes right to our table and sits down, because they had been directed by Otto Preminger in a stage show many years before.
Wow.
And they started reminiscing, and they're in stereo at one point. I had them both doing their imitations of Otto Preminger in stereo. I was in pig heaven there, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Lovely stuff like that.
That is amazing.
Pinch myself moments.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, just the memories you have are incredible, and movie fans such as myself and all the other people, we'd love to hear these stories.
And your show is about creativity.
Yeah, the creative spark. You know, I love to just chat with all kinds of different creatives, whether they're, I actually had an ESPN sports anchor on last season, and he was awesome. You know, I mean, there's creativity in everything, right? And so.
Well, as much as people poo-poo and say it was a conspiracy, the pandemic and the lockdown and everything. And I, of course, went into a tailspin. All of my appearances, a couple films, and my live theater and party entertainment, everything washed up, dried up. You know, I must have lost about 80 grand worth of work right away, you know, the first year. And I was like, how am I going to stay relevant? What am I going to do? And I went into a panic, and I got on a Zoom call, and Zoom was relatively new, at least to me, with Ron Campbell, who I had gone to high school with. Ron Campbell is an actor who helped start the Actors Gang with Tim Robbins out of UCLA. When he and Lee Ehrenberg and company were at UCLA, they formed this company in Los Angeles. And Ron was a brilliant talent who does often these one-man shows, the Bucky, the Buckminster Fuller Show, 101 Arabian Nights, so on and so forth. And he's a very gifted artist. Lee Ehrenberg from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies that he's famous for, and a whole litany of great character work that he's done. He went to the same high school. In fact, he was in that children's theater show that my wife and I were in. Kim, can you not do? Thanks. He, Ron, another actor, Matt Walker, who also went to the same high school, we all got on a Zoom call and we're like, how are we going to stay relevant? How are we going to, we've all lost gigs. This is crazy. Yeah. And we talked and talked and decided we'd do a pandemic version of Waiting for Godot. We'd do Zooming for COVID. And Ron and Matt had done it at La Jolla Playhouse, playing Gogo and Dee Dee, and I'd done it, at least pieces of it, in classwork, and Lee had worked as Pozzo. And so we did our roles. We rewrote it COVID-centric, and even got Bill Irwin to agree to do a cameo as Godot at the very end. And then we'd tape it, but my technology wasn't really up to par with the other guys, so I finally got caught up and taped mine, and then the other guys got work, and Matt got doing Homer's The Odyssey for the Getty Foundation, and so he had no time to edit since he was our main tech guy. I was like, oh no, but nonetheless, it kept us creative. Figured out how to do stunts and action using the computer, and interaction with each other, pushing and pulling, and sets and wardrobe and so on and so forth. So it was, even though it was frustrating that we didn't get off the ground, and while we were waiting to do our final version, another group of famous actors decided to do the same type of project, and we were like, oh no. But because of that, I started getting my confidence up with working through Zoom and virtually, and started working with a group out of London called The Show Must Go Online, who during that first summer of pandemic were able to do a bunch of, in fact, I believe they did all of Shakespeare's canon with actors around the world live. And they're all up on YouTube. The first, though, how I found out about it, a gentleman had adapted Back to the Future as if Shakespeare had written it, called Get Thee Back. And when I learned that they were still casting for this, I contacted the folk. And when they learned who I was, they kind of asked me, well, what would you like to play in this? And I said, how about Doc Brown? So I played Doc Brown in the first Back to the Future a la Shakespeare.
Oh, that's awesome.
And did everything in my living room with my wife being my costumer, my stunt coordinator, my set dresser, my backup, even, you know, the slide for life from the clock tower. Anyway, we did a fun edited version, very silly, that's on YouTube as well. And then I played Toby Belch in Twelfth Night for them. So those are on YouTube as well. On YouTube, a producer out of Oregon who did the last Blockbuster documentary, he put together fans from around the world to recreate Back to the Future Part 2 and in 88 scenes. He got 88 different fans to do pick a scene to recreate, and that is called Project 88, I believe. And then some others did Back to the Future Part 1, and I did cameos in both those. And then another pandemic show, actually it wasn't a show, it was really a workout. The Actors Gang had an offshoot called The Cabinet of Oddities, where we'd get a prompt every couple weeks and fill the Zoom call with about sometimes a dozen, maybe up to 20 different actors getting on. And in the first hour, based on the prompt, the theme, you would do a monologue or a song or a poem, some sort of offering. And in the second hour, the director would, whoever was doing it that week, would spotlight a couple of the actors and maybe up to four in improvs for the next hour. And it was a really great outlet for creatives who were dying for an outlet during the lockdown.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, what obstacle or obstacles have you turned into an opportunity? And it sounds like this was kind of one of them.
I think I shared three or four of them. Yeah.
Yeah. What gets you excited to take on a new character? And what do you hope to get from that experience?
I get excited by other people's passion and good stories. You know, I can't, if it's something that I can't put down, or if, you know, I get sent scripts really often. Often I'll meet people at fan cons or people will find me. I'm not so difficult to find. I have a website you can email me through. And people want validation or help with their scripts or what have you. And a lot of the time I have to say it's maybe not so great. And I try to be kind and say, you know, this needs work. You know, if I'm not grabbed in the first 10 pages of a script, it probably needs work.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the first 30 pages, I'm still not grabbed. You know, I'm going, oh boy, we're treading water, or it's two talking heads and they were doing a feature, which is a visual medium. And they don't get that. They haven't trained, I think, or studied or realized it. And I'll try to gently help them along in their creative process. My time is now a little more precious, getting older. I'm like, oh boy, I don't have time to read all these scripts unsolicited or what have you.
Right.
And I understand why agents and production companies, you know, we don't look at unsolicited scripts because it's, you're giving away the store kind of. But I love it that people are passionate and may need a hand or some direction. If I have the bandwidth, I try to help. I love talent that takes their craft seriously. And I've had young people as young as 8 years old, 9 years old that I've mentored and have watched them bloom and make a career in Hollywood or go another direction. One young lady that I did start mentoring when she was 9 years old now is a lecturer at homeschooling conventions and is a world-class slam poet. You know, it's just lovely to see what direction folk take. I had a 13-year-old boy contact me, and by the time he was 16, we were co-starring in a film that he helped cast.
That's
the next year, he went to Hollywood and co-starred as Bootsy Collins in the James Brown biopic at Universal. It just thrills me to see people who are driven and passionate. And if I can help them along, I will. And if they can, you know, in turn find me work in their future projects, I love that. I worked with legends like Greg Araki and Catherine Hardwick on very early projects in their career, if not their thesis, John Schwartzman, you know, people who have gone on to be big names and, you know, people who I thought, you know, might eventually find something for me down the road in their projects. Quentin Tarantino's producer, you know, was a friend of mine, and I, you know, they're not calling, but eventually I still have hope that they'll turn around and find a small support role for me or something.
Well, I agree. I mean, I've just in maybe the 3 years that I really hit it hard, I was trying to do a lot of things at the time, act, write books, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, I got too spread thin. But what I did notice is, you know, the people that you meet, the good people, you know, you just stay in touch, and you're absolutely right. Networking is so crucial in that business. You know, it's just like 5 years later, you know, you make friends with somebody and then they're doing something and you get a part, or vice versa, or they'll pass on your name to somebody else. It really does pay to be a good person and to network.
Very true. It's also important not to be a pest.
Yes.
But checking in every 6 months or so, I think, is not unreasonable. And often, you know, if they are feeling bothered or can't be bothered, you'll get that vibe.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you just have to be sensitive enough to not become a pest, because then you make a bad name for yourself. It can, all in all, it is a small business.
Yeah.
People talk to each other.
Yeah.
But if it's your dream and it's in your heart and you've got to pursue it, by all means do. And keep a journal for your business connections, and keep a journal for your creative, those stories and the characters, your dreams, all these different things, elements come into play for putting together characters. I mentioned briefly earlier on, mm-hmm. you know, we draw on our traumas, our scars, characters that have these deep wounds, these traumas, they manifest in behaviors. You know, they study Michael Chekhov and his training of for actors with character gesture. There's things that afflicted your character in their past histories that create the behaviors and why they behave the way they are. If you're playing a bad guy, bad guys usually don't know that they're bad. They think they're justified, or their behaviors are just fine based on their histories and experiences. And it took me a long time to finally get out of the habit of surface performance, of surface characterizations, and get under the skin and find motivations and the colors. And often all the history that you write and all the idiosyncrasies that the colors that you think your character has because of their histories and so on and so forth, you kind of get that solid during rehearsals and practice, and it becomes second nature. So then your main focus is being in the moment with all these colors behind you, you know, that pop up during performance. Yeah. I asked my friend Dean Cundey, who was a cinematographer on all three of the Back to the Future movies and Jurassic Park, is nominated for Mandalorian right now and for an Emmy. And I got to visit him and Zemeckis on Death Becomes Her. And Meryl, got to watch Meryl Streep work for a day. And I asked Dean, I said, you know, was Meryl really put to task much by Zemeckis? And he goes, well, you know, Bob seemed to want many more takes than she often needed to do. You know, put her to task just so he had backup for choices, you know, and sometimes as many as a dozen takes or more. And what she would do with each take was remarkable in that they'd be fresh. Each take, she would make a different choice.
Wow.
With action, with inflection, with whatever the scene called for, it would be truthful, authentic, because of a different choice she would make. And that's a sign of an actor who really does their homework.
Yeah. Yeah. I before we got maybe another 10 minutes or so, but there's a couple questions I really want to talk to you about. I'm also a big fan of Mark Twain's work, and I actually saw Hal Holbrook do his thing about 30 or 40 years ago in Salem, Oregon, where he portrayed Mark. Now, I know that you do that as well. And
I'm currently wearing my Twain mustache right now.
Ah, I love it. Of course you are. Yeah.
I got certified as a docent at Columbia State Historic Park.
Oh, wow.
And I've been training the volunteers there and other docents how to kind of up their game and do their town tours and their Dickens shows and different events in first person, as opposed to saying during 1850, I did this, or we do this, or this is how we live, but rather make it live by talking about the news of the day or what's going on in there. And the coach has just arrived with a letter from back home, I hope, you know, putting it in first person. And because I'm now doing the town tours, I kind of break a fourth wall and explain to the visitors from 2023 that I, from time to time, will speak in your terms, as in explaining what the money from 1850 is worth in 2023, where you're from. But where I'm from here in 1875, I was in this neighborhood in 1864, and I'm reminiscing about what I learned about 1850 and 1852 that went on here. So, you know, I'll preamble the tour to that and then have that as a through line. I think I'm figuring out how to be Twain talking about Columbia Gold Rush in 1850, 1852, that era, but still trying to stay in 1875-ish Twain that I'm portraying.
That's amazing. I mean, his stories and musings are off, you know, very famous. What do you like about sharing them? I mean, what I don't know. What's it like being able to do that?
He was a very colorful man in that he often spoke his mind or his truth. He was often, when he was younger, kind of boneheaded. He had brushes with death, made some really bad choices, especially in his early writings. He was not in favor of women's suffrage. He was not conscious of a lot of abolition. He grew up with his uncle's farm had slaves and didn't think twice that there was anything wrong with it. It wasn't until he went out into the world and saw how the slaves were being transported and mistreated on his boat that he was ferrying down the Mississippi, or meeting Aunt Rachel, a friend of his family, and learning the stories about her family being torn apart, both her husband and her children taken from her, and so on and so forth, that he finally came around to being an abolitionist, or his wife hitting him over the head, having had suffragists in her family. And even his beloved daughter, Susie, talking him into helping her with animal rights. She wanted to make bonnets for the horses driving the taxis in New York City, you know, because of the heat, looking down on these poor creatures. He even took on Teddy Roosevelt and the imperialist movement, because when he did his world tour late in his career, having to lecture to get out of bankruptcy again, seeing how the residents of the empire were treated in India and Australia and elsewhere, you know, in Puerto Rico and Cuba and by the United States and so on and so forth. So he was swayed from being on the wrong side often of an argument to the good side. And he had such a great eye and ear for characters. At the end of my tour, I always read the famous Jumping Frog story of Calaveras County. You know, Simon Wheeler telling that story about Jim Smiley. You know, I get to exercise different characters in the stories, which is delightful fun for me and hopefully for the audience too.
Oh yeah.
So I'm having a creative outlet that where I actually make no money. I'm not allowed to charge as a docent, but it's good exercise for me. And also, you know, as I age, find kind of a niche where I could probably take these Twain things to the various places. You can take,
on the road.
Yeah. And I've, there was another thing during the pandemic. I developed and even got a small grant to help develop Mark Twain's American History as I know it, which I'm still determined to make into a 12-part series with actors playing these various other roles, Twain debating Teddy Roosevelt or Twain listening to Aunt Rachel's stories. And, you know, such great richness that knock on wood, I'll still do that.
I hope so too. Hey, this has been so much fun. We could go for like 5 hours, but as the time is winding down, I always like to ask my guests one final question. What does creativity mean to you? And what do you do to keep the creative spark burning?
Well, creativity is listening. Mm. Listening to your own history, stories in your life, and advancing on them, or using what you've learned to share with others. It's collaboration, it's spark and inspiration, it's listening to your dreams, to your heart, to what people need, enlightening, entertaining, and educating. Sometimes it's not listening at all and seeing what comes out of the silence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's all that. I've seen example, a young fella I know who was in an improv workshop that I was in. He's become now a filmmaker, and he has epilepsy. He, Miles Levin, he wrote a short story based on a young man at his prom who is an epileptic and is crying in a bathroom, and a young girl has compassion and tries to help him, and it turns into a romantic story. And Miles is getting all these awards now for this beautiful film he made, and that's going to eventually be a feature. You know, just using what you know, and then seeing where the story takes you, and honing your craft to where, you know, you, what's the term?
Don't kill your darlings.
Kill your darlings. Because in service to the story, you know, if it's too precious, you know, rewrite it.
Yeah.
Keep it honest, keep it authentic. And
keep it moving.
and tell your beloveds that you love them while you're alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That was a lovely answer. Wow. People, I'm going to put all of his information on how you can reach Jeffrey or learn more about him in the show notes. But his website.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. His website is jeffreyweissman.com, JeffreyWeissman.com. Jeffrey, this has been a blast catching up with you. You're such a good guy. And
sure,
you're such
People are Back to the Future fans, they want an autographed picture, I charge, you know, fair market value. And you can email me through that website. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter, or I have a Facebook fan page. That's best because the private page is at its 5,000 limit.
Mm.
And it's been a pleasure, Brian. Thank you for thinking of me and having me on.
Oh my gosh, it was my pleasure, and it'd be fun to keep this conversation going sometime.
Yes, I've got a couple projects that are in post and one that I'm currently filming. So have me back on. I'll talk about them.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson, his latest best-selling book, Habits for Success, and this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. And we love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.